I've got Maggie Hunt with us here today. We're in Edinburgh University right now, and Maggie is a graduate of Edinburgh University. In fact, she's graduating tomorrow.
Yeah.
Arabic and French.
Yeah, exciting.
And so Maggie's agreed to kind of share her story, her dyslexia story, with us. We're just going to hear the big story of her life so far and how dyslexia has influenced her and what kind of dyslexic tools she uses, and maybe you as a parent can learn a few things from this that might help your teenager, or maybe you're a teacher at school and this might help you as well. So welcome, Maggie.
Thank you very much. Hi.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
No, thanks for having me. This is exciting.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about yourself, just as an overview. You've just done a degree at
Edinburgh, yeah.
Edinburgh.
So yes, I'm graduating tomorrow, and I studied Arabic and French. That kind of came about because I always enjoyed talking. Mm-hmm. So I'd always enjoyed sort of studying French and traveling to France when I'd had the chance, when my family went. And Arabic kind of grew out of an interest in colonial history and the relationships between France and the rest of the world. And I just kind of figured if I can learn the language and read the sources in the original language, then that'd be pretty cool. And if not, then I'll just change my degree and it'll be fine.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was kind of a bit of a challenge I sort of set myself. But it was more, I tried not to put too much pressure on myself at the beginning. I was just sort of trying it, and then at the end, I got quite stubborn and just sort of stuck it out, even though it was really hard. So, yeah, that's where I'm at in my life at the minute.
So, in this podcast, we're going to follow a pattern with different segments. So, first of all, I'm going to talk to you about your big story.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to talk about dyslexia and find the threads of dyslexia through your story. And then we're going to talk about what kind of dyslexia tools and so on that you use.
Mm-hmm.
So, big story first. We're going to talk about the beginning, what woke up your potential, what challenges you faced, and what kind of rewards you've got out of that journey so far.
Mm-hmm.
So where did it all start for you? Where are you from? Are you, you're
I'm
not
from
Scottish.
Near Cambridge, sort of Cambridge, Bedford area, so quite close to London. Yeah, I don't sound very Scottish at all. But I really loved Edinburgh when I came to look at the university, so that's why I'm here. Going back to the beginning, wow.
Where would you start your story?
Very early on, my mum was a teacher and my dad's parents were both teachers as well. So they were both quite, reading and writing was quite well integrated into my childhood. Especially obviously there wasn't much technology around then, so that was sort of all there was to entertain me. God, that makes me sound really old. I don't mean like no videos, I just mean there weren't apps. I loved reading as a kid. My mum would sometimes read to me in French because she teaches French and music now. We'd sing a lot, just because my mum was a music teacher, so there was no escape from that. And that, I kind of, people sort of knew me as quite a sort of, I guess, intellectually curious, quite like smart, but quite, so yeah, I was quite socially awkward, I guess. My sisters were very good for me in that sense, sort of, you know, ribbing each other and knocking each other's Lego down. Definitely the reason I have a personality now.
Are you the oldest?
Yes, I am. Okay. So they sort of plummeted into my life and it was never the same again. So kind of a bit of a geeky kid, to be honest. But, you know, I was happy being that way. So I guess that was just kind of how it started. And we moved house at one point, and this kind of links to your potential kind of awakening sort of concept. We moved house, my dad started working abroad, and my younger sister came into the world all within about 6 months. And then I started school, and it was quite a stressful time for 4-year-old me. So my mum eventually took me out of school for a couple of years, and that was probably the best thing that could have happened for me. I know a lot of kids probably wouldn't have reacted well to that.
So your mum took you out of school?
Yeah.
We're talking about the second question, what woke up your potential?
Well, it's so ingrained in the beginning,
yeah.
I guess.
So that's the moment that really woke up something in you. So what do you mean she took you out of school? Did she homeschool you?
Yeah. So I was in school for maybe a term, and I was depressed as a child, but obviously I was 4, so I didn't know that. But she was really worried about me, like I wasn't eating properly, I wasn't sleeping properly, I hated being there, and she was like, this is not healthy for a child. And I wasn't really learning anything either, because you know, when you're at that stage in school, you're learning a lot of things that you can't be learning at home anyway. And she was a trained teacher, so she was like, I'll try this and see how it goes. And my sisters, she didn't homeschool. They were perfectly fine because I think they had a lot longer to sort of settle into everything. So, yeah. But because I was taken out of school for 2 years, I was really able, like, it was all so tailored to me that, you know, I wasn't in a context where I ever would have learned I was dyslexic because I was just doing everything pretty quickly because it was all one-on-one taught. And yeah, I was quite a voracious reader as a kid anyway. Loved Harry Potter, started reading that when I was about 5. And I remember my dad was on a work trip in France and we got to go along and we were sitting in the sort of accommodation and I maybe lost my first tooth that day or something. It was quite an auspicious occasion and I was reading the Sorting Hat scene and asking my mum what an exclamation mark was. And that's like a really early memory for me, that just that sort of scenario. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of tailored education for the first 2 years of formal education in my life, which definitely meant that I was able to excel where I could excel. And the bits of, and I wasn't a slow reader comparably because I was doing so much. I was just way more practiced than your average 4-year-old. So, and also a lot of growing up books, they've got smaller font. So I have scotopic sensitivity. I have to wear those coloured glasses for reading. And smaller fonts help with that because it's closer together, so your eyes have to process less sort of visual space to see the word.
Oh.
So I think that probably also kind of helped that I was reading smaller fonts quite easily. Everyone was just like, wow, she's a great reader. So
you got a lot of positive reinforcement in all of that as well.
Yeah, completely. And because it was so tailored to me, I just kind of flourished as a kid. And then after a couple of years, my mum was like, okay, you're ready for the real world now.
Okay.
And went into proper school. But because I'd had that sort of solid foundation, I was really quite often like ahead of the kids in my class because I'd had 2 years of one-on-one teaching from someone who was a qualified secondary school teacher. And because she was my mum, she sort of recognised where my strengths lay and stuff. So that was, I sort of grew up feeling like I was quite clever and being very bright. But also I hadn't really... When you get to uni, you have to work really, really hard at everything to sort of churn out. And at that level, none of it requires that much sort of labour, I guess. So I definitely...
When you're younger?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're writing a story at once. You've got no coursework. You've got no essays. You've got no tomes to read.
So when did the challenge happen then, in the story?
Yeah, what was the big challenge one of those people who... got by on being bright until suddenly at A-levels I'm going to be doing a lot of reading and I just don't really know how to tackle it because I'm used to reading in my own time and enjoying it.
Wow, you managed to manage all the way through until A-levels.
Yeah, like, well, my school, my GCSEs, because I was getting C's and above and everything, I'm sure, you know, it was a massive school and they did have good support and funding for people with dyslexia. My sister really benefited from it, but because I was doing fine, you know, why would you sort of pour your money into a kid who's going to be fine anyway when you've got other children with way more serious dyslexia and other issues to put that money to.
So you're kind of like at the moderate dyslexia level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I am my sort of report they did. There's like, it was kind of like an IQ test and 100 was like sort of your average. And I was like 50 points worse at symbol interpretation
than everything else.
Yeah. But I, you know, IQ tests, they were kind of my jam. It was problem solving. It was great. So I was still doing pretty well in everything else. So like actually compared to a sort of average person, you're not that bad. It's just when you compare it to how good you could be.
Yes, that's right.
And yeah, I definitely attribute that to having had such a sort of solid, there was never any negativity and never any limitations in my early education.
Yes.
So I just was in a very good sort of headspace to tackle up to GCSE level things. And, you know, I wasn't one of those who sort of got all A stars, but I did well for my school and then was able to get into a good sixth form college because I picked subjects no one wanted to study. So there was space on the courses for, I was doing German, double maths and religious studies or something. Like, nobody wanted to do them. So, yeah, that was kind
so
of like
my... So how old were you when you started to crash?
I'd say I started to crash around 16.
Okay.
And one of my religious studies teachers... was like, are you dyslexic? Because she was like, you're fine in class. You're clearly not, you know, actually stupid. You just always hand your essays in late and they're never as good as the things you say. But honestly, I because I actively disliked the reading because it was so much effort, I figured I was just being lazy. So I was like, nah, I'm not dyslexic. I just hate the subject. That was what I... And I didn't hate the subject at all. I loved the classes. It was just producing the coursework. And for English, reading a chapter of Frankenstein every week was
So you did the
drag,
classic
so.
Thing of attributing your dyslexia to laziness.
Yeah, completely. Because I was so used to doing well before with very little sort of issue that I figured I just needed to actually start working hard. A-levels can't be that hard, right? Like, and that was when I got tested for scotopic sensitivity because I was like, well, I don't like reading. And so they tested me for that. But my reading speed was okay, and the coloured glasses really helped in exams and coursework. They made a massive difference. So then
it
was
like,
what's your
colour then?
At the minute, it's very dark purple, but at the time it was pink.
Okay, it changes, yeah. Does it?
I think my sensitivity just got a bit worse. So before it was quite a pale purpley pink, but more pink hue, and now it's basically sunglasses, the level of sort of intensity.
But you don't
colour.
Have it on just now. You have clear
glasses.
Because
I'm not reading
now.
A lot. I've tried to not be too dependent on them.
Okay.
But
so
yeah,
I bring them out like reading glasses.
Yeah, exactly, okay. Exactly. Because I'm short-sighted, so these ones are just for seeing far away. Because otherwise your hair's quite blurry. So, that was sort of... Yeah, I definitely attribute those early educational years as having significantly enabled me to go so long without it being spotted. Because I was able to work to my strengths, which included problem solving and improvisation, all those classic creative dyslexic things. So it meant that even if I hadn't read the stuff, I could improvise a good answer and still do quite well.
Oh, yeah.
So,
and the point where you got... caught out, as it were,
was where the
was
hard
when
work
you had
met.
To write it down.
And where you actually had to be processing a lot of written material, and you couldn't, you know, make stuff up about Hinduism or French words or things about Frankenstein like that. There was a lot more, you know, GCSEs, the assessments were all creative writing and sort of problem solving in the maths rather
what
than
subjects did you do
for A-levels
for GCSE out
or
of interest. Did you go down the creative subjects?
I did. Our school, if we were sort of passing everything, gave us a lot more to do to try and get their average up, I think. So I did like maths, English, two each, and I did double science. I did French, German, maths, English, double science, French, German, religious studies, drama, an IT qualification, citizenship, and something else.
That's a lot.
Something else, and history. Yeah. It was a lot, but... So I think the variety kept me entertained because A-level was only four subjects.
Yeah.
You know, the attainment you were looking at was not your average, where if you're getting seen above in 13 subjects, you're doing very well.
Okay.
Which you can sort of improvise if you've got the right sort of mindset and the right home environment to support you in that.
Yeah.
But A-levels, it was way more specific, a lot more labour intense, and that was where it kind of caught me out.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So you got assessed for dyslexia, and what would you say has been the... How did you overcome the challenges that were faced? What was the challenge, and how did you overcome it?
Just sort of having to process a lot of reading and make the links between things, I think... Yeah, so I didn't get assessed for dyslexia until I actually reached university. I just got assessed for scotopic sensitivity, and that did make an improvement. But when I came here, I was like, I'm doing Arabic, I need to know... how to help myself, essentially, because this is not going to be an easy ride. And I'd taken a gap year to kind of reflect on if university was exactly what I wanted to do, because I was very happy with my A-levels, but I was like, is this it? Will I enjoy another 4 years of studying?
Can I pause you for a moment?
Yeah.
So your mum's a teacher,
yeah.
Your dad's a teacher.
My dad's parents were teachers.
Okay,
yeah.
And then your sisters... were identified as dyslexic as
just
well.
One of them. Yeah, one of them was tested but wasn't quite bad enough or something to actually get
borderline.
The official. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She's doing Russian. So
there's three of you.
Yeah.
And one was tested for dyslexia and was dyslexic.
Yeah.
Is dyslexic.
Yeah, she was tested in upper school, so pre-GCSEs.
And so when you
really
were in school, did you know that she was dyslexic? When you were doing A-levels?
I think in my gap year or my first year of uni was when she was tested.
So I'm wondering, why didn't you get tested when you got the eyeglasses thing? Why didn't you get tested for dyslexia as well?
They did a reading speed test on me. but it wasn't reading comprehension. It was just how many things I could read aloud in a space. And I'm a musician. My family sing in tons of choirs. My mom's a music teacher. So quickly regurgitating what was on a page is fine. Knowing what it was saying, I couldn't have told you what I was reading or what it was about.
But so
I
could, they think because you're fine.
Yeah. So they were like, it's just scotopic sensitivity. But then when I came here, I was like, you're a very well-endowed uni. You have enough money to throw at me if I do have it. And yeah, Arabic's not going to be easy to ride. So I do need to know if I can get extra time because that will make a massive difference. And then they were like, yeah, you're like half a person worse interpreting symbols than anything else you'll ever have to do.
That's incredible.
But everything else I compromised with, like, because every new word was a problem to solve.
I think that's maybe a dyslexic trait you just said. You said compromise. Yeah. Do you mean compensate?
Yeah.
Said compromise. Yeah. So you compensate with your other strengths for that weakness.
Because if I'm good at problem solving, a new word is just a problem that I'll have to take the time over, but I'll eventually figure out.
Yeah.
And actually Arabic was great for that because although there was a lot of hard learning new words by rote, which had no relation to English at all. Whereas in French and German, if you're stuck for a word, you can usually say an English word in that accent and get away with it. Arabic, unless it's internet or something, you've not got a shot in hell at all. But all the Arabic words are completely linked together. It's probably quite similar to Farsi, actually. I'm not sure. But so it's got sort of a root system, and you put the root into this sort of algorithm, and then it produces the actual word. Like, kataba is the root for to write. Fi'el is the pattern for a written...
So there's a real logic to the language.
Yeah, very logical.
So you, as a dyslexic, are looking for the bigger picture
and the patterns
and the underlying logic.
Yeah. So
and you can use the maths and the logic to get the end result without memorising the end result.
Yeah, so you'd remember the form that meant the thing that the verb has been done to. You'd put kataba, writing, in that, and that would make kitab, which means written thing, which means book. So even if you didn't know the word in Arabic, if you recognised the form and the roots, you could be like, well, that is someone who is being made to study, so perhaps a student. Like, so that was what I loved about Arabic. It's just there was so much to learn to get to that position. That was quite challenging.
So you got identified in university,
first year of university.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested in the people who wake you up to your potential and sometimes to your challenges in life and so on. Mm. Are there particular people in that journey, particular teachers, like you've mentioned a few teachers, or who reflecting back, who would you kind of thank for having kind of stepped in and said, you know, that was a really significant moment?
And firstly, definitely my mum for giving me the early years that meant I went so long without struggling.
Yes.
I think that, because there are lots of people who don't like it when you're like, this school is not good enough for my child, essentially. That was how they felt.
Yeah.
So she, you know, one of my grandmothers and a lot of people in the village, a lot of her friends were really quite, what's so special about your child if our school is good enough for our children but not yours?
Is our school not good enough for you?
Yeah, there was a lot of backlash, like in the streets. One woman stopped her and was like, she'll never learn to read and write. And mum was like, I'd quite like to post her a copy of your degree certificate once that comes through.
when you're 5 years old?
Yeah.
Was that when you were 5 years old?
When I'd been taken out of school, she's like, she'll never learn to read and write. Mum was like, well, she's already on the second Harry Potter book, so off you go.
Credit to her.
Yeah, credit to her.
Who's
for that.
Next on the list then? What'd you say?
My religious studies teacher, who asked if I was dyslexic, because even though that didn't immediately lead to the diagnosis, it meant I knew something was up. I got the scotopic sensitivity checked out, and that helped a lot. And it planted the seed for me coming to university and be like, I definitely want to, might as well get checked to see if I can get the extra time. Who else? My younger sister as well, because she's quite badly dyslexic. I think when you're struggling with something, it's quite hard to stick up for yourself. If you see someone you care about struggling with it, all of a sudden you care about it a hell of a lot more and you're going to stick up to everyone. So I think my interest in it, more than just a thing I said I had and dealt with, probably grew out of the fact that I was like, actually, she and I have this in common. What I learn at uni and can pass on to her to help her with her degree, because she's going to be doing English and philosophy. That is a lot of reading.
Okay.
Like, a lot of reading. I think, and Yeah, so I think the sort of family tie, I didn't realise it was really genetic until really recently.
Right.
I think actually my mum might be dyslexic. She really struggles with filling forms out and thinks very laterally. And will skim read without really processing stuff a lot of the time. So I think that was probably actually why she was so keen to tailor my education to me in the early years and so keen to shove reading down our throats.
Brilliant. So we've got four questions. What was the beginning of your story? What sort of things woke up your potential? Mm. What was the challenge you face? And then you're starting to talk a little bit about the rewards you're coming back with, helping your sister a little bit with some of your experience. What other things, what kind of rewards have you got out of this challenge?
Well, I would say because my degree was really challenging, like writing my dissertation was so hard. Because I love doing the researchy side. I was interviewing people. I was doing something I was really interested in, but doing the 10,000 words of typing and making something coherent when it's so long you can't even remember what you started with by the time you've got to the end. I think being able to finish that, I'm quite proud about it. It's just generally just rewarding. And I did it. I was doing a lot of extracurricular stuff because I enjoy problem solving and getting things done. But I still managed to get a great degree that I'm very happy I've done and a good grade in it, without sort of surrendering to just, I'm dyslexic, so I'm never going to be good at it.
Because you really did something that's quite unusual for a dyslexic to do. I mean, a lot of people, learning another language is one of the hardest things often dyslexic tutors and assessors say, and even in America, you get an exemption from the obligatory second language for university if you learn American Sign Language, because it's a visual language. So you get an exemption, but still a language, because it's recognized how difficult it is for a dyslexic to learn another language, and you've just done that and written a 10,000 word dissertation on it too.
Again, going back to my mum, actually, she's a music teacher sort of by training, but also teaches French to primary school kids now. My dad's parents were Spanish teachers, so I grew up around a lot of languages, so I often just didn't... I just wasn't told it was a hard thing to do.
Yes.
So
learnt it more orally than you did in this sort of
I was exposed to a lot of languages through my choral singing, for example. Yes. My dad's fluent in Spanish and pretty good at French. My mum spoke a lot of German when she was a kid, well, did like GCSE and really enjoyed it and sings a lot. So I was surrounded by it and didn't get so much as possible if you don't think it's something you can't do.
Yes.
And because I was so into talking, I often sort of joked when I was picking French and Arabic, I was like, I'm doing languages, so some of the assessment is not written, because I'd get to chat.
You get to talk, which is your forte. Yeah.
So I think, and then I picked Arabic just out of interest, just to see if I could. And actually there were, out of our class of maybe 27 for Arabic, a good 5 or 6 of us have learning difficulties.
Wow.
That's
a high proportion, isn't it? Because you'd expect maybe 10%.
Yeah, a good quarter of us are in that special extra room. And I think, especially because Arabic is so labour intensive, a lot of dyslexic people learn to work really hard to get what they want academically. And that definitely sets you in way better stead than just being bright when you start doing something as insane as an Arabic degree.
So part of the reward for you is the work ethic that's developed.
It's definitely changed because, like GCSEs, especially, in an environment where as long as you're not struggling, they can't give you more support because there are other people who need it more. I was just used to getting by fine without that much effort just because I was bright and mouthy. but here that was a complete change because Arabic is hard and there was a lot of coursework and a lot of written things and a lot of reading. And so I learned a lot of sort of study tricks and a lot of revision tricks. So I read slowly, for example, but thoroughly, and make notes in the margins so I never had to read it again.
Oh, I'm the same.
So, I think And I've actually gotten really good at proofreading because of it.
I read that in your blog.
Yeah.
I was like, and your proofreading, that's incredible.
I love it.
Dyslexic proofreader, now that's an oxymoron.
I had to take a year abroad. And the first 6 months, I'm going to be honest, were pretty, not dire, but not great. Because the school's teaching style, this was for Arabic, and it was just read that section of the book and then we'll discuss it, essentially, for a lot of it. And if you're reading that section of the book in class, you only get halfway down the page before everyone else in the class is ready to discuss it.
Of course.
So much of it, I was just not really getting anything done. And obviously my Arabic improved because I was in an Arabic-speaking country and I was still doing it. It's just I was only ever completing half as much and I needed to study for sort of 6 extra hours a day as well as the 4 hours teaching just to cover the material, which is impossible if you ever want to have a life or sleep or food or not just be manically depressed the whole time. So that was a bit of a sort of negative kind of awakening moment where I had to be like, just be good and just be happy with doing what you can do. Don't expect to complete everything. Don't expect to be the best in the class or anything, because you're just doing what you can do. At the end of the day, after this course, you'll have sat X hours of Arabic written exams, and that is an achievement itself to not have come out of any of them crying. So, but then the second half, I was doing this internship in France. And so I was better at French, so it was already off to a good start. And it was working, it was practical, it used a lot of problem solving and not much writing. But there was a lot of stuff that needed translating, and sometimes into English, and sometimes the CEOs would do it themselves. And the head of marketing would get me to proofread things. And I think once she just did it out of politeness because I was a new kid, to be honest. But she was like, actually, you spotted so many mistakes that other people had missed. I said, it's because I'm looking for twice as many as you're making, because my writing is so riddled with them. I'm used to having to read through everything 6 times when I'm proofreading it, and I've developed a decent method for it. So I think, yeah, that's another skill, brilliant, I think, that has been very helpful. And I love editing other people's writing as well, because it's way more interesting than reading my own. So
tell me about your blog. You started a blog.
Yeah, that was initially just revision procrastination, I'm going to be honest. But it kind of started out of a girl in one of my French classes was working on this project with some others to start an annual Edinburgh University European Languages Department creative writing magazine. And I was like, I've done some writing in the past. I've been doing content writing for my sort of student job. I'll give it a go. And the theme was sort of self-reflection or something suitably wishy-washy for a sort of creative thing that's supposed to inspire you. And I was kind of thinking, I was like, I don't fancy, you know, opening up about any dreams I've had recently or whatever. But I was like, actually, I could do about being dyslexic, because that's more of a cause, I guess. Again, with my sister having it, I'm a bit more protective, a bit more sort of openly, I guess, motivated to discuss it and educate people on it, I suppose, than if it were just me, I'd kind of just let it slide. So I was like, okay, I could do a poem about it. I'll do it in French. It's a, you know, that's way better than my Arabic, so the Arabic poem would have been a nightmare. And it was quite a simple poem, you know, it was nothing. I'm not going to win any prizes for it, but I really enjoyed doing it and discussing the editing. One of the editors was like, so we want to take out all the punctuation and capital letters to make it hard to read so people know what it's like with dyslexia. I was like, no, this is for people with dyslexia to finally read and be like, yes, don't make it hard to read. I won't be able to read while you are publishing. Please don't do this. And after a while, they were, yeah, that was a dumb idea. Sorry, we suggested that. But so they, in the end, they printed a really simple font and they printed it on pink, like paper, because I'd said about psychotopic sensitivity, that really helped me. And I got some really nice feedback about it, actually. And I was like, you know what, people, and I started Googling dyslexic writers, and because I was trying to sort of find inspiration initially. And there was no kind of source for anything like that, really, where people really discussed normal people's experiences. You hear a lot about celebrities and a lot of people's sort of major success stories when they're Keira Knightley or Richard Branson or whatever, but there's nothing really, there were very few resources for that. And I was kind of thinking it'd be great to have a resource where people could practice creative writing if they are dyslexic, and then they get that exposure, they get that practice, and it's not just sort of writing in their room and then throwing it away at the end of the day. So and other people will be able to see it and potentially be inspired or emboldened, because they'd be like, if they can do it, I can do it too.
So your blog is not just for your writing, to share your writing,
yeah.
Your blog
my
is to
my sister
help
and one of my friends are
other
working
people
on some stuff for it.
Publish
the
there.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got you. So...
And obviously I'm the only one at the minute because it's only about a month old.
Okay. So,
yeah.
So your dream for the blog is that it becomes a platform for other dyslexics to share their creative writing.
Yeah. And their experiences as well. I want to share tech that I found really helpful. I'm going to be writing a post about how mind mapping has really helped, for example, and techniques, and people sharing the stories of how they got through their degrees. And book recommendations. For example, last night I published a review of a book called In Her Shoes, which is about two sisters. And the reason I picked up on this book was because one of the sisters has my name and one has my middle name. And one of them is a dyslexic hot mess called Maggie, and one's a lawyer with her life together called Rose. And basically it's a lovely sort of character arc with a solution at the end of the dyslexic girl has solved the sort of multiple problems that have developed throughout the story. It's quite a sort of chick flicky read, but it's really sort of heartwarming.
What's it called again?
It's called In Her Shoes by Jennifer Weiner. I don't really know how to pronounce it. I don't know if it's American or German.
Okay.
But yeah, and for a sort of summer holiday read, it's very simply written, and I just loved that it sort of had, you know, the very together girl, which is what I tried to be with my middle name, and then the sort of hot mess with dyslexia with my actual name that kind of, so that was why. But so yeah, recommending things like books and films. There was a film I watched about a girl who really struggled with dyslexia but wanted to be a doctor. And the scene where she is explaining, or the sort of professor is explaining scotopic sensitivity to her mum, honestly had me in tears, because I was like, I'm not alone in this. This is exact. Because I'd always been, why do I find smaller fonts easier? For example, all my other friends prefer larger ones. And then they have this scene where they've printed a piece of paper, but as if it's stuck in the middle and been twisted around it. So only the centre word is really very still and the rest is like a wash. And they show that to her mum, like, this is what she sees when you're reading. So don't buy her bigger font books. And I was just, that's me. And so, you know, I was like, if
that's
other
a great
people...
way of describing it. So it's kind of like in the centre, you've just got a small
one
area
word
of focus,
at a time.
And if the word is quite big, you're only seeing a few of the letters.
Yeah. Or
whereas
half
if
of
it's
the
small,
letter.
You see the whole word.
Which is why I struggle with a whole sentence rather than an individual word, which is, so when I was being tested for dyslexia, I could read each individual word fine. I couldn't tell you what I'd actually been talking about.
Okay.
But yeah, so recommending things like that, where people can see people with dyslexia represented positively, where people can read about other people's experience and be like, I'm not alone, I can be a writer if I want to.
Where can people find this blog and how do they
so
contribute?
So it's called Thislexic, because I love puns. And it's just on WordPress. And I've got an Instagram and a Twitter set up. So it's also, I have another blog, which I started in my gap year, reviewing vodkas, because I basically wanted writing practice and to maintain being able to write and research things throughout my gap year.
Okay, what's that one called?
That one's called A Vodka Blog, because I'm imaginative as hell.
Okay.
But they're sort of linked on WordPress.
Okay,
anyway.
Great.
And I know if you Google A Vodka Blog, that comes up quite highly, because it's, you know, been around for longer, so you can always find it through that as well. I've always...
Dyslexic
yeah.
is up in the first page on Google.
Is it?
It's about number six, five or
fantastic.
Six, so you're
well,
there.
Who knows, maybe once my sister's stuff is up, we can shunt it up a place higher. I'll get on the SEO.
So we've covered...
general story.
Your beginning, the potential, the challenge, some of the rewards. What's next?
Yeah. What's next for
You're
me?
Going to London, did you
yes,
say?
Yes, I've got a grad scheme lined up from Monday, so that's exciting. I'm really looking forward to... I was saying in the interviews, I've really missed sort of getting stuff done, because obviously when you're studying, you're so absorbed just in all the reading and writing, and I did a lot of volunteering where I was sort of managing events and stuff, and that was what I really, really enjoyed. The problem solving, essentially, and thinking creatively and thinking lateral, all those skills that I developed because I couldn't read as well, now I'm going to be able to use them in a practical sense in the working world.
Great.
So, yeah.
So down in London, you've got a graduate scheme. What are you going to be doing?
So the company is a company that does sort of headhunting and due diligence and market research and project management consultancy, and the scheme is... I do 2 month stints in sort of every different area, and then at the end, if they like me and I like them, then I pick where I work.
Brilliant.
So yeah, assuming that department liked me back, obviously. But so yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So let's move on to the dyslexia segment, as it were. Yes. Although we've been talking about dyslexia,
it's hard to separate it.
It is, isn't it? And but I like to start the blog, the podcast, focusing on life as a whole.
Yeah.
Because we're not defined just by our dyslexia. Yeah. You know, dyslexia is a massive influence in our life.
Yeah.
Positive and sometimes negative. Well, often negative. So we've traced the influence of dyslexia. Are there other... this segment is, where can you trace the influences of dyslexia? And I think you've done a pretty good job of tracing them. Is there anywhere else?
It's been
so
integral to my experience of education, and that's been such a huge chunk of my life.
Yes.
I think, so far, I think it's probably quite hard to...
disentangle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the things that can be tricky for people with dyslexia that aren't to do with reading, they've been obvious and they've been part of my life forever. But because they weren't just me reading slowly, you don't pick up on it.
What about organisation?
Yeah.
You know, we've talked a lot about reading and writing, comprehension and so on. But what about organisation? Which is one of the things that's hidden in the whole talk about dyslexia. We just take it for granted. Are you quite a disorganised? How are you with organisation?
I have to sort of consciously do it, but I kind of enjoy doing it because it makes everything easier. I sort of geek out about it, like, you know, pictures of bullet journals online, love that stuff. Putting things into boxes, great, because it simplifies it. You know, if you can categorise things,
you've got a bullet journal in front of you right now.
Well, it's quite, it's not a very attractive one. My sister's one is full of glitter and colours. Mine is just biro and sort of highlighter. But it helps you articulate everything, and it helps you prioritise, and it helps you visualize things.
So you need to very intentionally organize your life, otherwise
very. And I enjoy doing it, but I'm naturally, I forget things a lot, sort of dates and times, and for example doing history GCSE or Islamic history modules, I'd really struggle to put two and two together if two events happened in the same decade unless I was told that they directly affected something. So you know, I'd have to build timelines where I could be, oh, they are in the same decade. I wonder if so-and-so announcing he was going to invade, you know, this country influenced this country's involvement in the Crusades. So it is something I'm kind of good at when I do, but I do have to do it. You know, I can't remember people's birthdays off the top of my head. Or I could remember the birthday, but the day could come, and unless someone said it in the right way or mentioned that person, I wouldn't be like, oh, it's so-and-so's birthday.
So basically, you have to externalise it all.
Yeah, completely. I have to... Yeah, 100%.
Let's talk about learning moments. And this segment's about... how do you learn best? Mm-hmm. What are the really big learning moments you've had in your life, or significant turning points where you go, gosh, I really love doing learning this way, I really love learning that way. What's your, I mean, obviously you've read a lot, but is there other things you prefer? Do you listen to podcasts? Do you do training programs? Are you a YouTuber? You know, what's your way of learning?
I often remember things in sound bites.
Okay.
So for example, anytime I have to read anything in Latin, I will be hearing Stephen Fry from Harry Potter reading a Harry Potter spell in my head, and that will be my guidance for the pronunciation.
So you turn Latin into Harry Potter spells?
Essentially,
yeah.
Because that was, you know, I didn't go to a school where Latin was taught or anything, so that was my exposure to it.
Yeah.
And who knows how good his pronunciation actually is, it being a dead language and all. But yeah, so one sort of key moment, I think in my degree actually, where I kind of realised, because you always have those moments of self-doubt where you're like, do I deserve this extra time? Am I not just being lazy? Am I not just, you know, not good enough at the language to complete a paper and all the time, that kind of thing. But we were having a lesson in second year to do with preparing recipes. And the word for to grate, as in to grate cheese, can either be barasha or bashara. And my teacher wrote them both on the board and said them. And I knew there was a difference, but I just couldn't work out what it was for the life of me. I was staring at the words, I was listening to it, and I just couldn't... She could see in my face I was, like, upset and lost. And she, bless her, just took ages sort of pointing to the letters and repeating it until I was like, ah, those two letters have switched around. That's what's different. But, yeah, like, I remember the sound of it. I wouldn't remember how it was written out. I learned my presentations for my final exams by listening to them way better than writing them out over and over. Because when I'm writing...
So what was your learning moment? I'm trying to...
Just that... I mean, it was more, actually. It just... I realised that, actually, I did need help with a lot of stuff and it was okay.
Okay.
But also... that it took more than just seeing something written down to help, because if I hadn't had her saying it, I wouldn't have noticed they were even
I completely. See, so you needed, I think what you learned there, you're saying, is you needed that feedback to see it and hear it and that kind
and
of
feedback. And now I'm never going to forget how to say grating in Arabic, which is a pretty niche thing to remember, but it's been completely ingrained in my head. And yeah, so like the little sound bites are what swirl around in there rather than remembering how to spell things. Now, luckily, Arabic is a phonetic language, like German. All the letters just have one sound, whereas, you know, in English, you can have per,
much harder.
Her, for way harder to spell just from listening. So luckily, the sound bites helped in that kind of case. But
I noticed something in your blog where you said you got 15 minutes extra in the exams.
Mm-hmm.
But your 15 minutes extra was a non-writing 15 minutes. Now, that's quite interesting. So you got 15 minutes to concentrate just on reading.
As well as my
reading.
Extra time.
Oh, so you got some extra time at the beginning and some extra time at the end. Explain that a little bit.
So the extra time at the end was just to give me a bit more time to physically answer the questions. The 15 minutes at the beginning was just reading time. So you're allowed to highlight and underline, not allowed to make any essay plans or notes or anything. And, you know, you can have some kind of, I don't know, dots next to it if you know that that's the question you want to do or whatever, but, you know, you're not allowed to actually start answering. It's just to get through the paper so you've read the questions properly.
So another student might spend 5 minutes reading the question paper all the way through and decide, I'm doing question 1, 5, and 6.
Yeah.
And then go back and start question 1. Yeah. Whereas what you're doing is you're reading all the way through and then reading it again and reading it again.
Taking the time
to really making sure.
Prime myself,
yeah.
Essentially. Because one issue that actually I never really attributed to dyslexia, and I really should have, even though I was a bright kid who loved writing, I'd never read the questions properly, ever.
Yes.
From the age of 12, I'd always lose about 5 marks in every test because I hadn't properly read the question, or I heard the words in my head but not processed what I actually was asking.
Did you find that you made quite a few assumptions?
Yeah, loads.
I know what they mean.
Completely.
And you just carry on.
And even like my most recent exams, I can remember a question where I did that this time, but it was a paper with a lot of questions. It wasn't like essay questions, so it was just one word that I slipped. But so that really helped me because it forced me to spend a lot of time staring at, you know, an essay paper, there's only 4 questions on it, so you really have
it's
to
a long time,
break
isn't
it down
it?
In your head and highlight the relevant bits. And you can highlight in as many colours as you like. So, you know, who, what, where, when, or why, or what's relevant. That really helped counteract, it helped ground me, it helped me marshal my thoughts and start thinking what I could bring into it, even though I couldn't write anything yet.
Okay.
And it really helped me know what the question was asking. And break it down in my head, because so often, especially with history papers, one of my last exam this year, ever, hopefully, was on the Arab-Israeli conflict. And none of my answers were especially groundbreaking. I haven't solved anything. But all the questions were written so weirdly, you couldn't work out on first reading what they were actually asking for. But because I had 15 minutes where I wasn't allowed to do anything but read, it meant by the time I could pick my questions, I could take that time. Whereas if I hadn't had that time, I would never have dreamed of taking a quarter of an hour out of my precious writing time to think it over.
Absolutely.
So that was
that's a really,
really helpful, especially this
accommodation.
Year.
I think it's something very practical for parents to take away, you know.
Yeah, I think everyone, even non-dyslexics, could benefit it, to be honest. Because if you're, say, only a little bit dyslexic,
or a creative person, you know,
anything.
You're on that
like,
sort of spectrum. You're not quite dyslexic, but you're very creative. And
it's not like it would benefit you if you didn't need it. You'd probably just sit there bored, but it made such a difference to me.
Well, I mean, everyone needs to take that time. And for some people, it's 5 minutes to take that time. Other people, it's you know, 8 minutes, and for you it's 15 minutes. Yeah. And that's really nice to have that clarified and set apart, so you don't just rush on.
And they could also, you know, all the examiners could see, they'd have the numbers of the desks where people were having that time written down a list for them, and they could see if someone was writing, and they're like, no, just reading for you until 9:30 or whatever.
So when you got examined in the university, you were in the main room?
No, we were, there was a dyslexics room, essentially.
Okay, right, a group of dyslexics.
Yeah.
And did you type, or did you write?
Writing.
Okay, so you didn't get a typewriting accommodation, that's interesting.
Well, I don't think I'd have wanted it, because it was way harder to plan essays, sort of in bulleting form. And for Arabic, typing Arabic would have been a nightmare.
So you prefer writing the
Arabic.
Yeah,
and also, especially for languages.
Yeah.
Because, you know, because it's cursive, it feels fluid anyway, but they're English keyboards.
Right.
So I'd have been typing, and French keyboards are different because different letters are used more often and the accents are more accessible.
Uh-huh.
So it was actually quicker to write all the sort of extra fancy letters. And,
okay.
And yeah, using an Arabic keyboard, I type so slowly, so that would have actually been a hindrance. But I know there are people who do way better with it, because, but my handwriting speed, although my writing can get very messy, is still not actually too slow to function. It's the thought and the marshalling that takes my time.
Let's go on to the mind mapping segment. Mm. What's been your mind mapping experience in your life?
I think, that question kind of immediately calls to mind this book that my aunt got me when I was about to go to university and I didn't even ever use. And I kind of regret doing that now, because it was a really like nice looking book. You know, one of these books where
everything's
just clear.
Was it one of Tony Buzan's books?
Yes.
Mind mapping?
Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, I just flicked through it and I was like, ah, I know how to do this. But the A-level... where I could mind map, for example, English literature, sort of, because you have to focus on themes rather than individual book, and I was like, how am I going to link this all up? I can't draw these connections unless I'm physically putting it into, you know, articulating it externally, essentially. And that was my best, like, A-level by far, completely. I did that for my A2s, and I think I got like 4 marks in the exam or something.
Wow.
Like, nailed it, because I'd taken the time to mind map, whereas for maths, I couldn't really mind map, and I was sort of scraping a B, which, you know, I'm still happy with, and I was happy with, but, you know, there definitely could have been a different way I could have studied, and if I'd really thought about it, I'm sure I could have found a way, but I just sort of copied things out until it stuck in my head, which took a long time, and it just wasn't as effective as mind mapping was.
Do you think the mind mapping was faster for you in the long run? You know, taking the time to map it out?
If I'd learned to do it efficiently, it would have been. But I was still kind of... It helped me collate my thoughts.
Uh-huh.
But I was writing out long quotes. I was writing out... I was not doing it in the most efficient way. But it still really helped.
It helped, yeah.
Just to connect, to make the connections between different books. It
so
really helped.
How did you learn how to mind map then? If you put that book aside, did you actually...
Well, we'd done it a little bit in school.
You got taught a bit at school?
Yeah, our teacher would, if we were doing a group project in lower school, mind maps were the thing. That, and middle school actually, spider diagrams, classic, especially if we were trying to, I don't know, write a story, or our teacher wanted to find out what we already knew about something.
Okay.
Like, if I think we did The Tempest by Shakespeare, and so they'd be like, what do you know about Shakespeare already? Work on your tables, do a spider diagram.
So you'd use it as a brainstorming
tool?
Yeah,
brainstorming tool, completely. And actually, through my degree, I started using it a lot more for vocab learning, because I could learn vocabulary quite slowly, because it would just take a lot of time to take what was on the page and put it sort of into my head in a sound form. Especially, you know, if you're learning a new word and you're not 100% sure how it's pronounced anyway.
Okay.
I'd learn words and I'd be asked about it. But because, you know, I'd learned this word in a column in a chapter and the questions were always thematic, I'd find it quite hard to dredge it up.
Okay.
So I started doing vocabulary mind maps where I'd be, okay, this is my finance vocab that I'm having to learn. This is my politics vocab. This is my fraud vocab.
Are they the kind of mind maps that are all just words, or did you use some colour and pictures and so on to differentiate
them? I use a lot of colours. Like, I do sort of a fully yellow mind map for finance and a fully green one for the environment kind of thing, just so I could find it quicker when I wasn't wanting to revise.
Got you.
So it's sort of colour-coded. And yeah, and then I'd have branches that, say I was doing about money, I could have one for fraud, and then I could have banks, money laundering, and then from banks I might have, I don't even know, withdrawal or something. And sometimes I could link other words to different sections, and because repeating them would help less than knowing the link was there, if that makes sense.
No, didn't make sense.
So say I have a mind map and it's finance vocab, and then I've got bank, and then I've got fraud over here. Say I want to remember how to say signature. That would be useful in both contexts.
Okay.
Instead of putting it on both different legs of the spider, it's more useful for me to remember that link.
Because, between the two.
Yeah, because then it's more connected in my head than just a bunch of random stuff I'm having to learn.
So you're,
my problem-solving mind is the one that is actually doing the legwork here.
So what, from my experience with mind mapping, you know, you get different things from different aspects of mind mapping. You've really majored on the branching.
Yeah.
For the connections.
Yeah.
You know, you really got a lot out of using those lines to connect.
Connections are things I can't do in my head.
Okay.
So
you externalize the connections. And that's the whole thing with the timeline. Yeah. That's the whole thing with the mapping. Yeah. It's mapping it out outside you. You can visually see the connections.
Completely.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I was saying to you earlier, in lower school we'd have gym on Wednesday mornings or something, and every Wednesday morning I'd be surprised that we had gym. It would be like a special occasion for me. I just never was like, it's Wednesday today, does that potentially mean that that will happen every Wednesday? It just never happened in my head. I'd always end up having to...
How long did it take you to actually learn your timetable in a year when you changed?
I mean, I just didn't in lower school.
Didn't.
No.
What about
we were always in the
school?
We were always in the same room, except for gym and music, where obviously a teacher would escort us to where we needed to go.
What about high school, when you moved to different rooms?
Well, we'd get given visual timetables.
Okay.
So I'd colour code them and then just check them every morning.
That, how organised?
I just couldn't remember.
Did you take
it
with you as well?
Yeah, we'd have them in like our planners, and I'd have a photo on my phone. Because
I mean, a lot of people don't do that, but if you don't do that, you don't turn up.
I
had a friend who had a... When he was at high school, he would never know what he was going to be doing next. He's a dentist, and he's not been identified as dyslexic, but he knows he's dyslexic. And there was a girl who really fancied him. And so she memorized his timetable.
Oh, that's sweet.
And so he would go, oh, I don't know what I'm doing next. And he would know, oh, she's the one who knows my timetable. She would go to her and ask, what am I doing next? And she'd tell him.
Yeah, I couldn't remember. Honestly, even fourth year uni, I'd still be double-checking my timetable to check I was going to the right room for a weekly tutorial, just in case. Because, logistically, I'm very good at sort of organising it, but remembering it, I'm really not
so
great.
So classic.
So that's
so
why
classic.
I have to sort of externalise everything in a bullet-pointing system every single day. And, you know, mind map every plan for every essay ever, just because otherwise...
Oh, do you mind map all your essay plans?
Yeah, especially in exams, because that's just so much quicker than giving it a formal structure.
Yeah.
Just sort of quickly jotting down, I need some ideas, just put everything I can remember about it into it, and then try and make an argument out of that, because otherwise you end up just thinking, okay, I need 3 points, and then I need justify, counter-argument, evidence explain, blah, blah, blah. And you end up just sort of, it's a box-ticking exercise rather than putting in the extra stuff you could. And you get, you know, good embellishment if you remember, oh, that happened in 1066 too. Maybe that influenced it or something.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's definitely because my mind, things are floating around in it rather than very well filed.
You have
like
a zero-gravity brain, do you?
Yeah, and it's just like Sherlock Holmes's mind palace, but a bouncy castle.
Everything's stuck down.
I have to catch it, Quidditch, and then...
So we are into the advice section.
Mm-hmm.
This is the advice segment.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you, what advice would you give your teenage self, and what advice would you give yourself as a parent? So if you could go back in time, what time would you go to, and what advice would you give your teenage self? I tell you what, imagine this. Imagine I could get a little video recording, audio recording, and
post it.
Send it back to yourself when you were in a teenage year of some sort.
I'd maybe...
What would you say, and what time would we deliver it to?
I think pre-sixth form me could have done with a heads up for how much sort of working hard versus being bright actually matters. Because up until that point, just sort of being able to improvise quickly and being creative had been, that's enough to get your GCSEs because there's so much creative writing and involved and so much.
I tell you what, let's try something different
best
here.
Thing.
But imagine you're actually saying it to Maggie, your younger Maggie.
Oh God.
What would you say to younger Maggie? How would you speak to her and say, Maggie,
oh God.
You're in sixth form.
Oh.
Your sensible self.
Firstly, I think I would be like, you are dyslexic and you don't know it yet.
Mm.
Start researching that so you know your strengths earlier.
Mm.
Because techniques that got me through doing Arabic could have served me well for my maths A level. So, and if I'd known I was dyslexic and started researching it, I'd have known that, you know, I'm playing to my strengths in problem solving and things, so I just need to find a problem solving way to go about other stuff. Because, yeah, maths GCSE, I'd not learn formulae by heart. I'd do the long ways that involve working stuff out because of, but I've acted like it was just because I was showing off, but in reality it was because I couldn't learn a formula for toffee.
Yes.
Like, so I think, yeah, maybe I'd just be like, you're dyslexic and you don't know it yet. Look into it.
Take it seriously.
Yeah, take it seriously and push for getting a diagnosis as well.
Yeah.
Because, actually, yeah, if I changed my work technique, I would have been too effective and not ever got diagnosed with dyslexia. So I think just knowing I had it would have really helped. Because my religious studies teacher, when she was like, are you dyslexic? I was kind of, what? No. If I'd known, even if I'd got a positive diagnosis, that would have really affected how I'd gone about studying with my A-levels. And I'm very happy with the results I got, so it doesn't really mind, but it would have just been good for my self-knowledge and self-confidence, I think, to know it earlier.
Better to know it sooner than later.
Yeah, it's better to know yourself as soon as you can and then know your strengths as soon as you can, essentially.
Thank you. So, yeah. Parent,
yeah.
Going forward in time, what advice would you give yourself as a parent? Or maybe to other parents who are listening?
Definitely, diagnosis is key. I'm going to be watching my future children like a hawk for signs of dyslexia because knowing sooner just helps everybody get things. And also it means that if I'm a bit dappy and forget a date, my boyfriend knows it's because I'm dyslexic and it's just how my brain works rather than me not caring,
yes.
For example. So diagnosis is key and also helping kids develop good habits. For example, my mum encouraged a love of reading early on and that carried me through for 16 years. You know, imagine if that hadn't happened. I'd have really struggled way earlier. And fine, I would have probably got my diagnosis earlier. But by that point, I'd have thought all reading and languages is impossible and would have completely shut down. So yeah, developing good intellectual curiosity and good habits for it, rather than just being curious, actually acting on it and working hard about it. Because I remember at that seminar the other day, someone saying, maybe it was the last guy who spoke, he was chatting to this kid who'd said, I can't do it because I'm dyslexic and just shut down. And he was like, no, it's because you're lazy. You can do it. Your brain just works, will do it a different way. So, yeah, diagnosis is key in developing, like instilling good habits and a good motivation to be curious and do things well. Because that's what I had. And I really, like, I only really started appreciating it during my degree when, you know, I'm one of the only state, I was maybe one of the only two state educated kids in my entire Arabic class.
Mm.
And the only reason I got there is because I had the good home environment to sort of push me up. So yeah, instilling good habits and having that diagnosis, I think, are probably the key things.
So what kind of tools do you use to help with your dyslexia? This is the next segment. Mm. You know, we talk about different tools that you find helpful for thinking, for organizing, different gadgets, maybe apps. What sort of things do you use in your everyday to help?
Other than sort of mind mapping and externalizing and writing list after list after list after list.
You've got a journal in front of
you. Yeah. It's all just things.
Does it go everywhere with you?
Yeah, completely. Uh-huh. This is maybe my fourth in a row now. I started doing it on my gap year to sort of marshal my Arabic studying, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I have a shelf full of journals that go back to 1992.
Well, I plan on having that. And yeah, it was also good for, because, you know, you can have a homework planner, for example, but you'll have so much more to do in a day than just your homework.
Yeah.
So having, you know, I could have color coded it. I think I used to do different symbols. I don't really do it anymore. I've got really lazy. But so I'd have a symbol for homework. I'd have a symbol. I'd put things that needed doing on a specific day. I'd put a different symbol for events, so I know that actually that was time I couldn't be doing anything else. So yeah, definitely externalizing it and coding it so I can look quickly and, like, I highlight the things that I have to do today and the rest is just good if I get around to it.
Okay, so your journal and coding.
Yeah, journal, coding, getting apps that have a colored overlay computers and my phone really helped, especially because so often when you're, you know, you don't want to be on a train with your purple sunglasses on, really, because you get weird looks from everybody. So having that purple overlay would mean I could read an article without having to whack them out.
Yeah.
And they're free. You know, I got a lot of software from the university to do that kind of thing, but I have a free app that does it for my laptop and I have a free app that does it for my phone.
Okay.
So that kind of thing. There's a font called Dyslexi, which I use a lot. When typing essays, I use that.
Why do you use that?
It's very easy to read. It's designed specially, so it's sans serif. And also, they're all kind of weighted heavier at the bottom. They're a little bit bolder at the bottom, all the letters, so they don't move around as much. They're also, so one issue people have, particularly with English, is that lots of letters have the same shape. For example, D, B, P, Q. They're all slightly characterized differently, so you've got less of a chance of mixing up in your head.
Oh, okay.
And the T and the L, for example, are weighted differently to sides, so you've got less. So it just makes it a smoother experience.
Okay.
So I'd like copy and paste. If I had to do a reading, if I could copy and paste it rather than just printing it off, I'd copy and paste it into a Word document, put it in that font, and then print it off.
All right. Because so, it just so it's reduced, not just a gimmick then.
Yeah, it just reduced the visual really stress.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a panacea at all, but it is.
It's helpful.
It just it reduces the visual stress a lot and. It does look a bit like Comic Sans, so you can't hand in an essay in it.
Okay.
But I'd use it for typing out my essays, especially for proofreading. And I'd also change the colour of every other sentence when I was proofreading. So I'd know where ideas started and ended. I could see if a sentence was too long without just staring at a bunch of black and white text. And it also broke it up in my head. And then I'd just change it back to black when I was actually sort of giving it. And that, it's a painstaking trick to, because you've got to do it manually.
You are thorough.
That's pretty thorough. How my degree happened.
You like went through every sentence.
Yeah,
and
well, I do it as I was going along.
As you went along.
Every other sentence. Yeah.
Wow.
But
now that would be an interesting app.
Yeah, I wish
that did it automatically
happen.
For you.
Oh my god, that would have been amazing. But it really, like, it was
there's
so
a,
much worth. The
there's an idea was, out there for someone
yeah,
to do.
An it was app. So worth the effort, but an app would have made that a lot easier. I'd also cut and paste into Google and listen to it back. Because I had software to do it as well, but then I changed my computer and it wasn't compatible with it. So just pasting it into Google Translate and pressing the little sort of speaker button. And then, yeah, it reads it out like a robot. But if there's rogue punctuation or a spelling mistake, it
you
reads
hear
out.
It
yeah.
Rather than see it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think they're the sort of tips and tricks, I guess, I used. But, yeah, definitely technology-wise... filter things and dyslexia font made a huge difference in just because you do have to write and read really long things at A level, at university, and actually at GCSE. Like, you're still doing whole books.
Yeah.
So,
what kind of tech did you actually use? I mean, there's a lot of tech that's thrown at dyslexics if you're lucky.
Yeah.
But what's actually useful for you? And what
well,
did
yeah,
you
I
dump?
I got a text to speech thing, but it just took so much effort to set up. And to be fair, I wish I had set it up for when I was transcribing interviews for my dissertation. That I was very much kicking myself.
Did you say? Did you mean text to speech or speech to text?
Both.
Okay.
Both. So it would read it out. It was called like Claro Read, but you could also have a headset. But that was just a lot of fuss. So I just honestly just didn't bother, and I could copy and paste it into Google Translate anyway. And I'm actually quite a quick typer, and I was quite good at annotating PowerPoints and things, so I never really needed to transcribe anything until the interviews I was doing for my diss. So that could have been useful, but I didn't suffer from not having, not actually using it. And yet, but yeah, the software.
Laptop, phone, iPad.
I use my laptop a lot. One thing, I got the smallest like MacBook possible because then I could carry it everywhere, because learning vocab, for example, there's this website called Memorize where you can make your own vocab lists. And what I found out in third year is you can type it all into Excel, Arabic column, English column, and then paste it in rather than having to type everything individually. Okay. So having a really transportable laptop meant I could take those notes in class rather than having to, because I'm very slow at typing things from handwritten.
I think this podcast will be very useful for other dyslexics who are doing languages and foreign languages.
Well, those are really good tips. You don't
realise
how common dyslexic language students are until you're sitting in the dyslexic room for a French exam or something, and it's actually quite a sizable chunk.
Yeah, but, it's a bit of an eye-opener for me, because I often think, you know, maybe dyslexic self-select and then don't go down that route and go to other routes.
Well, a lot of us at Edinburgh, you know, very well-off, very supportive backgrounds, a lot of us got diagnosed very late, because we had the decent foundation to sort of improvise up until
post-GCSEs. Isn't that fascinating?
Like, I would be very surprised if someone who wasn't as sort of lucky in me as having a teacher for a mum, for example, felt like they could do languages. Because I was always told, whatever you do, as long as you put your mind to it, you'll be able to do it. And by the way, languages are what everyone does, so which are you going to do? But that, you know, that was a unique thing. So, and a lot of people at Edinburgh as well, like, say, for example, you're privately educated, they do have the money to test people who are still sort of seemingly clever for things like that. So they will get an earlier diagnosis, but will get all the support. Whereas if you're in a state institute, you know, if you're running an institution, you've got to prioritise the ones that are suffering most. And, you know, I was getting seen above everything, so why would you bother even checking me? I was doing fine. But yeah, so it's definitely sort of a lucky few dyslexic linguists, no doubt about that at all. But hopefully, you know, someone who's feeling a bit discouraged at the minute will listen and be like, actually, I'm going to show those poshos what for, and I'm going to do a language too. But yeah.
Well, Maggie.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Talk.
Yeah. No,
thank you very much for doing this for the parents who are listening.
No, it's important that it's talked about, so it's great that you're doing this.
Yeah. And your, remind me of your blog again?
Thislexic.wordpress.com. WordPress. Oh. There we go, there's the dyslexia. Thislexic.wordpress.com. There we go.
Thank you, Maggie.
Thank you so much, Iris.
See ya.
Awesome.